Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Who would have thought Greenland would be close to the top of the Trump foreign policy agenda? Some are calling it the new imperialism, with the caveat this includes looting America's allies. Also, what is behind Elon Musk's war on Europe? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And in Istanbul, we have Tariq Saril Ammar. He is a historian and political commentator. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick this off with George. George, I mean, considering all the things that we've heard from the Trump, incoming Trump administration, particularly Greenland, and that's kind of a rubric for a much more boisterous, anomalous approach to foreign policy than we've seen, particularly since the unipolar moment. I guess you could argue that there's no real difference. It's just the way it's being framed right now. But, you know, it does kind of harken back to great power politics, which critics of the Biden administration are saying, where's all the realism? We need more realism in American foreign policy. Well, this is part of realism. You may not like it, but it is kind of a return to that. George.
I agree entirely. And I think the consequences will probably be noteworthy. Trump has always had a certain hankering for great power politics. I think he has looked as a model, the sort of the 19th century imperialism in which great powers acquire new territory, acquire new spheres of influence, that they regard subordinate powers as required to follow the lead of the great powers. And essentially, this means that it's the national interests prevail. Well, the alternative model, and you know, it has been the dominant model since the World War II, but particularly so since the end of the Cold War, which is the system of global alliances. But global alliances driven by ideological diktats. So suddenly we have this, the Cold War model was, we've got to fight this, the spread of communism. And everybody, all the countries of the world have to be scooped up and shoved into this alliance, irrespective of what their interests are, because they need to be waging this war against communism. Since the end of the Cold War, it's been about values. It's been about the democracies versus the authoritarian regimes. And what that means is that the countries that are on the outside are permanently threatened. I mean, it's a constant because this ideological alliance being led by the United States is a permanent threat. And of course, it's a very real threat because it's in the name of these principles of freedom and democracy. The United States-led alliance wages sanctions, wages actual wars, bombing, color revolutions, terrorist actions, all in the name of democracy. So Trump is suddenly now going back to an older model. Hey, we are a great power. We have our real interests. We're going to pursue our interests. But the corollary of that is that when we recognize other great powers and we recognize their interests, and we don't want to mess with that. I mean, that you know, what matters to other great powers, that's what matters to them. It doesn't affect us. So I think this, it may be, it'll all end up in exactly the same pot. But at the moment, I mean, it's a very much a different emphasis on the part of Trump.
The nitty gritty is in the details, study, because it's Greenland, it's Canada, it's the Panama Canal. I mean, these are not enemies of the United States, okay? There's no ideological spin there, obviously, as George has pointed out here. So, I mean, if you know, you look at countries like Russia, China, India, because of their strength and relative strength on the world stage, you can't loot them. They're kind of, you know, you missed out on that. Okay, you didn't dismember Russia for looting. So if you can't loot the other great powers, and as George rightly points out, it means that you recognize them as great powers. That's progress. That's progress in my book. Okay, but if you're not a great power and you're in the sphere, the American sphere of influence, well, like I said in a program last week, if you're not sitting at the table, that means you're on the menu. Tariq.
I think you're right about that. I'd add one thing, as it were, which is that the weird thing about the United States is that even when it pretends to follow an ideological rationale, right, it still also is doing geopolitics all the time of a very brutal kind. But I agree with George that some sort of difference is might be occurring, something important. But you know, you have asked about what happens to the smaller powers, right? Your point, Peter, is, if I understand you correctly, that at least they're recognizing they're more or less equals, the other great powers, and that in itself could have a stabilizing effect, right?
Sure.
If, for instance, the United States had recognized Russia as a full great power with its own national security interests in 2021, maybe we would not have seen the escalation of the Ukraine war, right? That's a very concrete thing. That, I think, is true. That would be a plus. But here is a problem I see, and I would leave it at that for now, which is the issue with the United States for, I think, more than 100 years has been the way they define the sphere of influence. And that's a separate issue. The United States is a state, and I think it's the only one on the planet, I'm sure it's the only one, that defines the planet as its sphere of influence, right? So to get a system where national great powers with national interests sort of respect each other, right? You get a multipolar balance. You would have the United States would have to learn to think of its sphere of influence as not the globe. That is one thing, right? They would have to think, okay, China has an Asian sphere of influence. Russia has a European come Asian sphere of influence somewhere. And we have, well, it would be once again the Monroe Doctrine, right? We have Latin America, maybe we have Greenland too, but we don't think it's our business what happens in Australia, for example, right? And that would have to happen. The United States would have to turn itself into a regional hegemon. They're not that right now. The United States is trying to be a global hegemon. And if they combine that with a new open assertion, even more brutal assertion of national interest, then we are in for a very bad ride, I fear.
Yeah, and it's early days here. I mean, this whole thing about Greenland and Canada and Panama, I mean, it can also just be a bread and circus as a ploy for the MAGA base, okay? Though you and I have talked at great length. I mean, geopolitics is in play when it comes to mineral extraction. That's very much part of today's world here. But, you know, George, I mean, we've been hearing about the rules-based order and all those countries, particularly when we think about Ukraine, all those countries that sent their military equipment to Ukraine, okay? And now, you know, the United States, but I think we're going to, you know, thank you very much, but we're going to take Greenland. I mean, all of these countries that believed in the rules-based order and the American sphere of influence are now just left, their American allies that are left naked and defenseless. I mean, there's nothing they can do about it. And we'll talk about the feckless leadership of Europe in the second half of the program. But I mean, America's allies have not disarmed themselves in front of Russia or China, but they've disarmed themselves in front of the United States.
No, that's right. I mean, and what has happened here is that these allies have indeed abjectly followed this the United States orders and have pursued this a war that had nothing to do with their own national interests. And of course, they should always have known that at some point, the United States is going to raise all kinds of issues about relating to their own national interests. And so what the United States has done now is saying, well, you know, we have these global alliances. Well, that's very nice. But what do we get out of these global alliances? We, you know, our people are impoverished. We don't live as well as the Europeans. And why don't we live as well as the Europeans? Well, because we spend so much money on the system of alliances. And so we can say, well, you know, you're going to have to spend a lot more money on your on this alliance. And incidentally, you're going to have to stop doing all these things that are harming our industries. You know, we're just not going to take all
your... George, this is not a request.
It's not a request. And so, you know, they're going to Denmark and saying, well, you know, we'd like Greenland. And then Denmark will say, well, yeah, but, you know, basically you can't have it. And the Americans say, well, we want it, so we're going to have it because we run this alliance. And, you know, we think that this is vital to our national interest and this is vital to our security. And therefore, what's vital to our security, as you have admitted yourselves, is vital to your security. So we're just going to take it. And there's not even much of an argument that they can put up against
them. Yeah, but Tony, this is the argument that we're all equals as democracy, but when it comes to geopolitical interests, or our interests will always trump yours because we dwarf you. Okay, I mean, you already mentioned, you know, you can have this ideological driven alliance, and then you come geopolitics. The United States will probably want both at the same time, which of course is shortchanging your allies. But I thought we were all equals in this alliance. Well, no, it's not true. It never has been true, Tariq.
You know, I mean, one other way you could look at it is that what the Europeans have done, right, especially after the Cold War ended, after the late 1980s, and that's a long time. They've had a long time to think about this, and they didn't. One big mistake the Europeans have made is they have disregarded the fundamental rule of realist geopolitics, which is don't think so much about other states' intentions or what they say about their intentions. Think about their capabilities. And if they had looked at the U.S. in terms of capabilities and at Russia in terms of capabilities, they would have understood immediately that the bigger threat is obviously the U.S. because they are much more dependent on it in every way, and it has a horrifically large military, right?
And Teddy, can we just give an example of those capabilities? The destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline.
For instance, the capability of conducting all sorts of black ops is very much something that is within the American arsenal, right? So if they had only exerted due diligence, right, instead of just listening to narratives, and talking the talk, they would have seen the United States is inherently an extremely dangerous state. It may now say, oh, we are on your side as long as you obey us and do what we want. But what if that changes one day? And European politics, geopolitics since the end of the Cold War shows that they've never considered this problem, and now they're caught out by it.
Yeah, but I mean, George, but a country like Denmark can say, but we've done everything you said. You know, we joined the European Union. We joined NATO. We sent a couple of U-Hauls full of 1940s vintage weapons to Ukraine. We did everything we could. But that's not good enough, is it, George?
No, it's not good enough. No. And precisely because the United States can then declare, well, yeah, but, you know, we have really vital national interests. And, you've already accepted that you are completely subordinate to us. And therefore, you know, you're going to have to do what we say.
On the note of subordination, I'm going to jump in here, gentlemen. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion about some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. All right, Tariq, let's switch gears. You wrote a remarkable and long article, and I don't always like long ones, but I like this one because it was it kept harping away at what I believe, and this is one of the reasons why I want to talk about it. And the article is Musk is demolishing Western elites. They brought it upon themselves. It's an excellent piece. I suggest all of our viewers take a look at it. It's at the RT website.
Thank you.
Why do they deserve it? And why is Elon Musk doing this?
Let me start with the first question. Why do they deserve it? Because I don't know why exactly he's doing it. I have a guess. So why do they deserve it? I do know that. Because precisely what we've been talking about in the first half of the show, they have themselves humiliated themselves, denuded themselves of power, denuded themselves of leverage, and they have also behaved in a way that has cost them all respect, and for good reasons. If you look at the German case, we've talked about it before, but it is such a striking example. If somebody blows up your vital infrastructure and you just smile, you are done. That's it, right? No respect left for you. You could look at Britain, of course, at what they call the special relationship, which is basically, again, relentless submission to whatever America wants from them, be it brutally persecuting Julian Assange for years, and making basically ridiculing their own legal system in the public eye in the process, or massively participating in the Gaza genocide. So you have all of these powers in Europe than have been begging for American attention, support, and have accepted all sorts of American arbitrariness and humiliation. And now you have a big American oligarch, the biggest in the world, actually, who also has not only the ear of President Trump, who is sort of the unofficial vice president and more, right? And he is starting to let them feel it. So I don't agree with everything Musk says, not at all, right, factually. But the underlying fact that he is just illustrating to them what they've done to themselves, that is just a reality, right? Now, why is he doing it? I don't know. At times, I think I haven't given him enough credit, as it were, for his own ideological drive. But I'm coming to think that Musk actually has a fairly consistent and fairly important ideology to what he does, right? And it's an ideology that I don't share at all, but I think he acts out of a number of convictions, as it were, right? Mistaken, misguided convictions, but there it is.
Yeah, well, also, there's always that element of self-interest, which we always have to be very careful about. He didn't get rich. His path to his riches have gone through state contracts in many cases. Okay, yeah. I think he's a genius, a great person of his time, but he had a lot of help too. George, and Tariq is absolutely right. If you have no self-respect, why should you expect anyone to respect you?
No, that's right. But the attack on Musk has reached the levels of hysteria in Europe. And there you have to think that it is his ideology. I mean, this is the first time in a long time in which a billionaire and, you know, an influential now publisher doesn't subscribe to the kind of fashionable liberal elitist globalist dictum. You know, he's not a George Soros. He's not a Bill Gates. He subscribes to a very different ideological worldview. I mean, this is the Trumpian view. This is the Orban view. And this has caused absolute outrage on the part of the people who run the EU. And so they're thinking of all sorts of ways of, we have to do something about him, you know. And so, you know, whether it's Macron or whether it's Scholz or whether it's Ursula von der Leyen, or, well, she's sick now, but, you know, whoever is in charge at the European Commission, we have to do something about him. And then all the media, you know, writing these long think pieces about the threat that he poses to freedom and democracy. But you notice, first, the argument against him was, oh my God, he has allowed hate and hate speech and discrimination and anti-Semitism and racism to thrive on Twitter or X, even though they never really presented any evidence that there was any rise in all of these things. Now, suddenly the argument has changed. Oh, he's using Twitter X in some very nefarious way, which we don't know. He's changed the algorithm, even though they have no idea what an algorithm is. He switched it in order to promote his own brand. He's up to promote his own tweets. All he has done, he has allowed free speech. He has returned free speech to Twitter. That's what he did. He said he was going. I mean, it's not perfect. I mean, he's obviously there is some restrictions on speech there, but it's a huge improvement on the time when Twitter really was censoring, when Twitter really was just simply removing content that they just didn't agree with. So it's entirely a positive. He's clearly advanced the cause of free speech, and he's getting attacked for it and threatened very seriously.
Yeah, but is the reaction, the hypocrisy? I mean, politicians are fair game for criticism, okay? I don't understand the umbrage that's coming out of Europe. I mean, these are very beta-type people here. But Tariq, I mean, we have... the term isn't used very often, but I mean, we have forced regime change going on in Gaza using genocide. The West is behind the dissolution of the Syrian state. The Maidan February 2014, forced regime change. I'm talking about meddling, Western meddling all around the world. But when Elon Musk writes, say, oh, he's hurting my feelings in an interview with a opposition party in Germany, everyone thinks the sky is falling. I mean, again, why would you respect people that have such a thin skin? And the only thing they can cling to is an ideology that their electorates are rejecting left, right, and center. Tariq.
Look, I think that's why they are so hypersensitive, because their position within their own societies has become so weak, right? The way in which Musk has supported the AfD party in Germany is, I think, exemplary of this phenomenon. The AfD is fairly strong, right? It has its 18-20% in the polls. And the whole strategy of the establishment parties, of the traditional parties, is to freeze it out nevertheless, right? In Germany, usually you build coalitions, and they're saying never, never coalition with these guys. And Musk is disturbing that strategy, and they're so afraid of him because he could perhaps push the AfD into a place where that doesn't work anymore. And why is that so? Not ultimately because of Musk, but because people, as you say, are so incredibly dissatisfied with politics as usual. Now, personally, I would like to see Wagenknecht to profit from that and not the AfD, because I'm an old lefty. But that isn't the issue here. That's not the analytical issue.
But what you're saying, your political opinions are your own, and I respect it, but given your position, we would have a little bit more competition? Oh, yes. My goodness. That's the hell out of these people, because they don't want to have competition.
Yes, of course. I have consistently argued in several pieces I've written that ideas to prohibit the AfD are completely misguided, because that's not ever the solution. Definitely not. So I agree, we just need much more competition. And what you see in Europe is this attempt at cartelization in the center, what you could call extremist centrism, or basically illiberal centrism, really, right? And they consider everything meddling that disturbs that, and everything that they themselves do somewhere else, or even among themselves, to disturb elections or disturb outcomes, political outcomes, that's not meddling, that's okay. See Georgia, see Romania, or see Thierry Breton, who has just basically said, you know what, we did it in Romania. If we have to, we do it in Germany too, right? So they have absolutely no respect for the rules themselves. They have no respect for the rules themselves. And then they have nothing to stand on fighting back against Musk. So what if Musk is meddling? So are you. And you are already corrupting the political system with your constant manipulations. So what's left?
Well, I mean, George, you had the Labour Party meddling in the American election. I mean, we talked about that at great length here. But that's okay, right? I mean, again, they're like good terrorists and bad terrorists. There's good meddling, there's bad meddling. Mm-hmm. This is like lawfare against Trump. I don't understand what you're talking about. What do you mean? A good terrorist or a bad terrorist? It gets to the point where they just go into the realm of just illogic, and they want to paralyze any kind of conversation because we're more virtuous than you are. And that's why they have no case at all. After decades of elite recruitment to elite takeover by the United States of Europe, this is what you get.
No, it is what you get. And of course, this is what George Soros and Bill Gates have been doing for years. I mean, in terms of meddling, I mean, we know Soros and Gates, they fund newspapers, they fund all media outlets, they fund think tanks, they fund NGOs.
And Musk has Twitter. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. For years and years, there's been this web of these operations, and they have been used precisely for the color revolutions in Tariq mentioned, in Romania, in Hungary, everywhere else, where and no one ever said anything about that. Musk, really, that's all he has. And Musk, incidentally, is upfront about it. I mean, he has his views. He's very outspoken. He doesn't actually act somewhere in the background, surreptitiously, so no one really even knows. I mean, you always have to point out how pervasive George Soros's influence is. You have to list all the different organizations that he has created and that he has bankrolled and all the influence that he has. And of course, the moment you do that, out comes the scream, you're being anti-Semitic. That's a conspiracy theory. But at least with Musk, at least you can't talk about conspiracy theory. There he is. He just expresses his views and then he moves on to another topic. I mean, it's like, you know, 1 minute he was talking about the H-1B visas, getting very agitated about that. Then he's moved on to the issue of the grooming gangs in the UK, very agitated about that. Now he's moved on to the LA fires. He's somebody who's just, you know, he has strong views, uses his platform to advocate.
You know what they really hate him for? I mean, there's a lot of policy differences. We don't have, obviously don't have time for that. But what they hate him for is that he's a free agent. And neoliberalism, no individual has that, except for Elon Musk for some reason. And then he's such an anomaly. And he came up through a system that suppressed opinions, wanted uniformed belief. And this man just goes on his own platform and says what he thinks. He's one of the very few. I'm sorry, we've run out of time. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and in Istanbul. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, across that rules.